is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is The Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. My co-host, Dr. Wesley Francis, unfortunately is stuck in a long surgery. So I'm riding solo with my very special guest, and that is Dr. Inga Pratt, who is a Bahamian obstetrician and gynecologist. She's here to impart some inspirational knowledge to the women out there. Young girls, teenage females, younger adult females, and older adult females. And even if you're not a female, you know someone who is a female that you love very much, whether that's your daughter, your wife, your girlfriend, your grandmother. So we're trying to create a healthier Bahamas. And if we can save one life by today's show or improve the life of one life, we're doing a great service to our community. Welcome, Dr. Inga Pratt.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a while. I promised to come on for a bit, so I'm glad I was able to make it.
Well, it's never too late. It's never too late. So
I'll
just
be back as well.
Just a few inspirational quotes. Self-doubt kills talent. Do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better. Believe you can, and you're halfway there. So the audience always wants to know about Bahamian heroines, and you are one in your own right. It's a very difficult and arduous task to become a physician, much less to become an obstetrician and gynecologist who's a consultant. So tell us about your path. Tell us about your people. Well, where did you grow up? Your primary school, your high school, your education and tertiary education.
I am a true daughter of the Bahamian soil. True, true daughter. I grew up in Fox Hill, the great community of Fox Hill. And I believe becoming a physician was a calling that I had in my life. My grandmother, Charlotte Ramming, was a diabetic. She had about 20 plus surgeries. And she allowed me to give her insulin injections. You know, medicine has always been a part of my life. And I never considered another occupation. So it was a challenge because my home was very low resource. You know, my family didn't have a lot of money, but I was blessed with a quick brain and a community that helped me. So I attended St. Bede's Catholic Primary School in Camp Road. I was Roman Catholic. I'm Anglican now. And then I matriculated to St. Augustine's College on Bernard Road. So I was able to walk home every day. And then from St. Augustine's, I went to Beloit College. They have a great partnership with the Bahamian community through the Harry Moore Foundation. And then I went to the University of West Indies. So that's where I was able to get my medical as well as my postgraduate degree. And OBGYN sort of just fell into my lap. I didn't think I wanted to get up and deliver babies in the middle of the night, but I just fell in love with women and women's issues. And I have two girls now, so I'm a huge advocate for women's health. And I love your theme song because it talks about prevention. So that's why I do gynecology, because I'm able to teach about female issues and how we can prevent a lot of the illnesses that are present in our community today.
Well, I've known you for many years, and you have an excellent bedside manner, and you are well respected by your colleagues, and all your patients love you. So it's indeed a pleasure for you to be here. I think that your story can inspire a lot of young girls in Fox Hill and in similar communities who never thought it could be possible that they can be a consultant physician in any discipline. I think you are a beacon of hope, and I think that you need to go back into your community and speak to the primary schools. You need to, even if you could touch one person, get them to dream bigger than they ever thought was possible. That's what we need more of it in this society. There's too much hopelessness. There's too much despair, particularly for young men and even young women. A lot of them are going down the wrong road. But since you've become a consultant, what are some of the obstacles that you've faced in the community in terms of just resources, the difficulties working in the public system?
I think some of the biggest challenges I have faced would be miscommunication and misinformation. That's a huge challenge because it's hard for me to compete against TikTok or against information sent around on WhatsApp. So a lot of times when people see it in a palatable or a format that appeals to them, they're going to believe it. And it's hard to differentiate fact from what is said or personal experience, because everybody's experience is going to be very, very different. And of course, you know, we have challenges in terms of certain resources because medicine moves so quickly, especially in terms of minimally invasive medicine and options that are available. So it's just challenges with resources and making sure that we have continued resources.
Well, I think we'll try to get through as many fundamentally important topics in gynecology and even mention some of the obstetric issues out there to try to improve the quality of life for as many women out there as possible. So knowledge is key. The wealth of the nation is the health of the nation. Cool. We want this to be an interactive show. Please feel free to call in and ask Dr. Inga Pratt all the questions. There are no super questions. All the nagging questions regarding your female health and your female body. The telephone lines are 323-6232, 325-4316, and 325-4259. So a lot of things related to urology and gynecology, there's overlap. We both deal with female and male genitalia. But one thing that really has struck me, and I've spoken about it many times, and it's heartbreaking to me, is the fact that there's so many, it doesn't matter what age, but particularly when it afflicts younger persons who have their whole life ahead of them, young children, just got married, a whole profession to look forward to, and that's cervical cancer. And the truth of the matter is, at least since 2009, where they have HPV vaccines, human papillomavirus vaccines, you can essentially eradicate cervical cancer in this society and every society throughout the world. So when I see persons 25, 30, dying from stage 4 cervical cancer, which is a horrible OD in itself. They always get referred to urology because there's obstruction of their kidney. Many times they have issues with urinary incontinence because they develop an abnormal communication between their bladder and their vagina where they just have uncontrolled leaking all the time. Sometimes it's even to the point where there's abnormal fistula communication between a woman's vagina and their rectum, and that sees stool coming out their vagina while they're dealing with stage 4 disease. And many of them are in renal failure because their kidneys are obstructed, where we have to have a nephrostomy tube, a tube put directly into their kidney to prevent them from having to go on dialysis. And then I've mentioned it before, it's a very unpleasant odor when you have stage 4 cervical cancer. The whole ward, down the corridor, every physician, every nurse, every patient in that proximity it's indescribable, the odor, and that in itself is heartbreaking for a woman, maybe 25, 28, to be dying a slow, very, it's almost inhumane because they're in and out of hospital all the time. They're almost skin and bone by the time they die. The limited time, they have a 3-year-old, they have a 4-year-old, they have their husband and everything else. But the worst thing about it is it can be preventable. Every one of those deaths is preventable. And then when we speak about HPV, there's so much negativity out there in the community. I've gotten it many times. So even when I've spoken before about the unpleasant odor and the fistulas and everything else, I would see something on social media broad that I'm uncaring to be saying that, oh, women have an unpleasant odor. And what I want to do is to see nobody in this country have to go through that ordeal. What I would love to see is, if not in this generation, in the next generation, nobody is getting cervical cancer. No one has to go through that. And it's very preventable. Not only that, we advocate, obviously, for young boys and for young girls, preteens, teenagers, even up to the age of 28, young adult male and females, to get the HPV vaccine. Because you can get many cancers from men, head and neck cancers, penile cancers, etc. All those things can be drastically reduced. Talk to us about cervical cancer and women not going for their pap smear, not getting their HPV vaccine, or even when they're a grandmother, they're not encouraging or discouraging their grandchild, either male or female, from getting an HPV vaccine. There's a lot of misinformation.
Yes, there's so much misinformation about human papillomavirus. I think it's still a bit taboo because HPV is a sexually transmitted viral infection. What people need to understand is it is transmitted through sexual activity, whether it is through penetration or oral contact as well. So that's another method of getting it. And normally the human body clears it. It's when the virus persists that you have the change or the precancerous cells that turn into cancer. Fortunately, in the Bahamas, we have nationwide HPV vaccination. So it's a part of our routine vaccination protocol. So I believe that the preteens and the teens are routinely getting the vaccination. I can't confirm whether it's both males and females, but I know for sure that the females are getting it as a part of their routine vaccination.
It's widely available, males and females. Okay. But I'll play devil's advocate for the negative persons out there in the community. What are you telling me to go get HPV vaccine for my 11-year-old and 12-year-old girl and boy? You're trying to encourage them to have sex when they're 11 and 12 years old? What's your answer to that?
I always tell them that we want to have the vaccination on board in order for their body to build up the immune response. So if I give someone the vaccine today, they will not have immunity today. That immunity will take a few months, a few years to fully develop and get strong, in addition to a proper diet, you know, exercising and just being as healthy as possible. So you need that vaccination on board as early as possible. So all the data shows, or all the research supports, the best time is to give it in the preteen years, 11, 12, 13.
If we had a vaccine for breast cancer, if we had a vaccine for colon cancer, if we had a vaccine for prostate cancer, everybody would be taking time off from work and they'd be lining up to get it. Why is this taboo with cervical cancer? Is it just because of the sexual connotation?
Because of the sexual connotation, and I sometimes feel that certain subjects we don't want to discuss in the Bahamas. We have children. You know, I have a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old, and I don't want to think about them having intercourse someday, but it's an inevitability. So It's just, I think, the nature of the subject, it's more taboo.
And you don't want them to die of cervical cancer.
No,
you don't want them to get
vaccinated.
You don't want them to get head and neck cancer. And even for the males in your family, the loved ones in your family, you don't want them to pass it on. Mm-hmm. The worst thing in the world to see that your wife is dying of cervical cancer from HPV that you unknowingly gave to that wife, and you see her slowly dying over a period of 3 years, leaving you a widower with three children to raise, when all that could have been prevented if you had gotten the HPV vaccine. And a lot of men, a lot of women, they have little to no symptoms.
So HPV tends to be completely asymptomatic. If someone develops symptoms, it's usually abnormal bleeding, which in our population, we sort of take as part to the course of normal bleeding. When any abnormal bleeding, any bleeding outside of your period, any bleeding outside of that occurs after intercourse is abnormal and should be fully investigated.
I think that's a wonderful segue into a topic I think is fundamentally important when we have a well-respected and well-trained gynecologist. And that's what is overwhelming in this country, where the abnormal has become the accepted normal, where so many young women, or women even into going to the middle age before their menopause, with menorrhagia and dysmenorrhea. What's menorrhagia? What's dysmenorrhea?
So menorrhagia just means heavy bleeding. So menorrhagia is a term that we used a few years ago just to describe heavy bleeding with clots, and we now replace it with heavy menstrual bleed. And dysmenorrhea means you have pain during your period. So menorrhea is associated with the period. Dysmenorrhea is heavy pain during the cycle. And in our population, during cycles, women are accustomed to having heavy bleed, which falls into the category of a heavy menstrual bleed or a menorrhagia. And women have cramping where, especially in high schools, you see the girls in the nurse's office for the 2 days of their cycle, or even persons who are working, they have to miss work for the day or they're out of commission for the day. So it's normal in our population when it's truly, by definition, abnormal.
I mean, there are women that every single month, they're basically out of commission in debilitating pain, curled up in a ball with a warm water bottle against their lower abdomen, and they're suffering. They dread the onset of their menstrual cycle, and it can be we need to determine, first of all, it's abnormal. What is the cause? There are numerous causes for a heavy bleed or a very painful bleed, but the most important thing is even some of those can be sinister in terms of potentially something malignant going on. But the take-home message is that in medicine, we always determine what the root cause is. So you just taking something for pain, or even a lot of women are on narcotics 5 days out of every month. They don't know that they become an addict because of it, but they justify it because that's the only way they can survive. Right. I'm a single mother. I can't be laying in a ball for 5 days. I got to take my four kids to school. I got to work. I got to pay the bills. So yeah, so I'm going to be on Tramacet or Tramadol or Percocet 5 days out of the month for endless years. And they don't know the untold harm it does on their body, where they are becoming slowly addicted to those painful narcotic painkillers. What are some of the causes, both benign and malignant, for heavy, painful periods?
In our population, once women are investigated, once they recognize it's abnormal and investigated, we have numerous causes. Fibroids tend to pop out because...
And that's very, very, very predominant in Black women.
Yes. In Africa, people of Black descent have a lot more fibroids, which are... The official name is uterine leiomyomas, which means they're smooth muscle tumors. So they look like little balls. So even when you're scanning a patient, you can point them out. They look like little balls. So they tend not to be cancerous. Less than 1% of them turn into cancer. So fibroids above and beyond tends to be a very, very common factor. And then there's something called adenomyosis, which is basically a fibroid, but instead of it being in a ball, it's more diffuse. So it's sort of involving almost a large section or a section of the uterus. And up and coming are sexually transmitted illnesses that lead to what we call pelvic inflammatory disease. So instead of it staying sort of in the vagina and at the cervix, it creeps up through the uterus, through the tubes, and causes sort of adhesions, and that causes pain. And then a new kid, or something that's becoming more and more predominant, is something called endometriosis.
What is endometriosis?
Endometriosis is such an interesting thing. So there are two thoughts on what is endometriosis. So endometriosis basically is when the lining of the uterus or the endometrium implants outside of the uterus. So it can implant on ovaries, it can implant in the pelvis, it can implant on bowel, it can implant almost anywhere. So you could have menstrual symptoms anywhere in your body. It's almost like a hot poker. So it's believed when you are on your cycle and lay back to sleep, some of the lining, instead of it all coming out through the vagina, it goes backwards through the tube and into your pelvis. There's also another thought that we know we have cells that can turn into anything. So something, a process called metaplasia. So the cells turn into lining cells or endometrial cells. So the tricky thing with endometriosis is it can cause symptoms. It can cause the heavy bleeding. It can cause painful intercourse. It could cause pain, but we can't see it on scan. So it's not like our friend of fibroids that, you know, you can point out and see. And I think sometimes when patients, you know, they go from doctor to doctor or they, you know, they can't get any results because, you know, they may get a scan that shows, hey, this is normal. So in order to diagnose endometriosis, by and large, we have to do a minimally invasive procedure called laparoscopy, where a special scope is placed through the belly button, and then you sort of look around, and it has such diverse lesions. So it could look red, it could look brown, it could be raised, and it could go from very, very mild to very severe. And even if it's mild disease at laparoscopy, you can still have severe symptoms, because if it's embedded deep close to the bowel or anything, you can have symptoms. You can have, you know, bowel symptoms, problem passing stool. So it's a very disease, but it's difficult to diagnose.
And it can be a very debilitating disease that can rob you of your quality of life and cause anguish and pain, and even that for your loved ones to see you go through that. You can even have endometriosis of the bladder. You can have endometrial lesions where a woman would notice that they only have blood in the urine when they're having menses. Right. So it's a horrible ordeal. What about a very common polycystic ovarian syndrome?
So polycystic ovarian syndrome, it's more of a hormonal condition. So PCOS occurs when, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart because I have PCOS as well. And it's essentially where usually in most people, so there are different types of PCOS, but in most people, their ovaries, they have a lot of follicles or early eggs, but the eggs aren't developing. So every month, the eggs sort of stay at the same stage and they don't release an egg. So that causes the ovaries to be very, very bulky. So it's a typical look sort of on ultrasound scan. But why they call it a syndrome is because it's associated with challenges with fertility. So it doesn't cause infertility per se, but because you don't ovulate every month, it may not be as easy to get pregnant. It could also increase your risk for hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, obesity. We call it the metabolic syndrome. So it could cause you to be sick as well. And it also can cause signs of excess testosterone. So you could have abnormal facial hair growth, et cetera. So you can literally see it on the face. You could see it on the body.
Acne as well.
It causes, you know, chronic medical conditions that can affect your life. Weight gain that you can't. Because a lot of people with PCOS will say, well, I don't eat a lot. But it's like the chicken before the egg or the egg before the chicken, because obesity worsens the PCOS, but PCOS worsens obesity. But I just want to also indicate that that's not the only face of PCOS, because you have thin people with PCOS. You have people who do not have polycystic ovaries, but they may have the other symptoms. So you only need two of the three in order to be diagnosed with PCOS, and there are many different types.
Can you talk a little bit about the hormonal management of, say, uterine fibroids, endometriosis? Is the oral contraceptive pill, or is there a certain type of oral contraceptive pill that can help with the pain, with the excess bleeding, and et cetera?
So the first line usually is with good pain management. So we try to use the smallest dose of the pain killer to treat the pain symptoms, right? And also there's dietary adjustment as well that helps. The reason why you're careful with the pain management, as you know, is chronic painkillers can cause your kidney to fail or die. So we have to be very, very careful with that in fibroids as well as in endometriosis management. Then the next step up tends to be your oral contraceptives. So you usually take something with an estrogen in it and a progesterone in it, because the estrogen is good at helping to control sort of the hormonal changes associated with the fibroids, but the progesterone helps to protect the uterus from cancer. So you take combined pills. So those tend to work. There's a drug called Clara, or birth control called Clara, that's specifically marketed for uterine fibroids that tends to work very, very well. My absolute favorite is the Mirena intrauterine device. So it's like a coil. It's marketed for birth control, but it has great, it treats fibroids well, especially depending on the size, the location. And it can also treat endometriosis. So it's a hormonal device. It that's a second generation progesterone in it, and it treats these conditions very, very, very effectively. So that's actually my favorite of them all.
And what if a young woman, 22 years old, says, Doc, my grandmother and my mother say that I'm going to put on 20, 30 pounds if I use oral contraceptive pills. I'd rather deal with the pain.
So we have new, listen to me, like I'm young. So the newer birth control are very different from my grandmother's and my birth control. So estrogen tends to be estrogen. There are many types of estrogen, but the progesterone in it is what causes a lot of the side effects, like the water retention, et cetera, et cetera. So they're four generations. So the newer generations are the fourth and third generations. They have minimal to no side effects. So that is the information I'd give them. So we have great contraceptives now.
And if young ladies out there are saying, but Doc, ChatGPT and Google says that you can increase your risk of a heart attack, stroke, deep vein thrombosis, is it really worth me taking oral contraceptive pills if it can kill me?
So before we start any contraceptive pills, we have a great conversation with the patient. And really and truly, only if you are at significantly increased risk for any of these things, then you would be at risk. So of course, anytime you take anything hormonal, your risk for, you know, clots or heart changes can increase, but it tends not to be significant unless you're in a high-risk group.
Okay. I have the greatest respect for obstetricians because essentially you're on call all the time.
Yes.
Your patient can go into labor or feel distress any hour of any day, and you got to drop everything and just run. If you're with your family, if you're doing this, if it's your birthday party, you got to go.
Yes.
You have an obligation to that mother, you have an obligation to that child. So it's a selfless endeavor, and I respect you tremendously for that, and I'm sure your patients do as well. And I'm sure it's very fulfilling to bring children into this world. And so there's no greater joy than that. But when you have a lot of women out there who are suffering with female infertility, they've been trying 5 years to get pregnant. I see it as well from the male perspective. And when you look at fertility within couples, first of all, you don't define infertility for a couple until at least 1 year.
Correct.
Because even if everything is perfect, everything's perfect for two 20-year-olds, you only have about a 15% chance of getting pregnant every month. And you also have to be mindful that you can only get pregnant 5 to 7 days out of that month. So it's always good to know which are those 5 to 7 days. So they'll say, Doc, Dr. Pinto, I've been having intercourse 30 days out of 30 days. It's not helping. I said, you need to have an ovulation kit and know which are those 5 to 7 days. Even if you've been trying, you can double your chances by being intimate twice in those 5 to 7 days. What are some of the common causes for women having female infertility? You mentioned endometriosis. You mentioned polyovarian cystic. Are there any congenital disorders or any syndromes that are common in our society? Does diabetes somewhat reduce your female infertility?
It can. So I'm not too familiar with any congenital conditions because a lot of the medication that will cause structural abnormalities, particularly, they've been identified and they're not really a part of, you know, this generation's challenges. So comorbidities like diabetes, they do decrease your fertility because it can impact your hormonal profile and can impact how your body ovulates every single month. So it tends to be sometimes structural challenges where we have tubal blockages. It could be, we can't identify the cause. It could be the endometriosis. It could be pelvic inflammatory disease, adhesion. So that could be a potential cause, a tubal cause. But by and large, I'd say an ovulatory cause tends to be more common. We have women who experience, because women, we're born with our eggs. So we're not like men, where you make new sperm every 72 days. We have our cohort of eggs, millions, and then by the time we hit puberty, we're in the thousands. So as we age, the resources or the ovarian supply decreases. So, you know, some women have the challenge where the egg reserve is less for their age, and then also their body isn't ovulating, whether it's due to PCOS or other hormonal challenges. So we have, you know, a thyroid disease, for example. So there can be hormonal changes that decrease ovulation.
And in this modern ages, modern world, with modern women, a lot of women are stressing the importance of education, career, before they decide to get married or have a child. Would you advocate women, as you see them reaching 32, 33, they don't have any partner in sight? It looks like marriage is not going to be in their immediate future. What about freezing eggs?
I am a huge advocate of freezing eggs. So I do advise my patients to freeze eggs. So every year I have a conversation at your annual, what are your reproductive goals? If you clearly say to me, doc, I'm not interested, then we put that aside. And I advocate for it because it's always an option. It's easily accessible. So we have several centers that are close to us, United States, Cayman, and the world is getting smaller. You could even go to Turkey. And the option is to freeze your eggs, and you have that resource available if you decide at 45, at 47 to have a child at that point. And if you don't need the eggs, then you don't need the eggs. But it's always bad. Prevention is better than cure. So it's always important to take it. So I feel that I discuss it, but not everyone takes me up on it, because you always hear the anecdotal story of Sally, who got pregnant at 47. She tends to be the exception and not the primary sort of person, you know what I mean, scenario. Yeah.
So what are some of the reasons when women are delaying getting married until much later in life, when they delay having children? What are the risks for a 42-year-old, a 43, a 44-year-old to have a child at that advanced age? For my memory, high-risk pregnancies start at the age of 35, correct?
So beyond 35, you're considered to be advanced maternal age. So nobody likes to hear it. I write it in when I write out the patient risk, I write that very, very small, because, you know, nobody wants to hear it, and there's a psychological component. But after 35, you're at advanced maternal age. And, you know, you carry the risk of more comorbidities in terms of increased risk of hypertension, increased risk of diabetes. Also, you know, just overall ill health during a pregnancy. But I believe if you are very healthy when you get pregnant, if you had your ideal weight, you eat a healthy diet, you try and exercise, I don't think age factors in as much. And then, you know, we also consider the risk for congenital abnormalities, but that's less of a concern now because there's so much genetic testing available. So you could do genetic testing from from 11 weeks gestation. So that's less of a concern now.
But then that brings up a broader issue. Yes, you can do genetic testing and you can know at 11 weeks whether you have a child with Down syndrome, but then it's illegal to have abort a child in our society. So that's another issue as well.
So I believe certain things need to be reformed. And until that day, I think knowledge is power. So it's good to know, and you have options in terms of how you want to manage the pregnancy, because not every pregnancy persons may opt to terminate the pregnancy. So it's always best to know what's happening.
And then you have older men. They say there's no age limit for having a child. You could be 80 and have a child, technically correct. But as you get middle-aged and older, you can even increase the risk of autism. You mentioned congenital abnormalities for women. Down syndrome even cerebral palsy, etc. So you have to be mindful that you're going to be at an older age and you may be 45, 46, have a child with Down syndrome, and that might be the only child that you have. Who's going to take care of that child with Down syndrome who cannot function alone in the society once you pass away? So there are a lot of questions that you need to ask in terms of, you always have to have a not even a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, a 20-year plan.
Right.
But what do you think, this is just as a personal question, there's obviously no right or wrong, this is your opinion. What do you think of the trend that a lot of women in the society are putting off getting married, putting their career first, and then I've seen it, I'm sure you've seen it, many of them regret it, because in the end, many of them never get married, or they never, or they get into the wrong marriage because that's their last option, and that's even worse than never getting married, or have one child when they wish they had three. And it seems like a lot of other demographics can get their education, have their career, and then still have that marriage, still have that child. But for many Bahamian women, they can only see that they can only do one thing. What's your opinion on that?
I think for Bahamian women, we have a lot of pressure. I could say that because even before we're adults, we are the sisters, and my chores were very different from my brother's chores. And what was expected of me was very different from what was expected of my male siblings. So I think we have a lot of pressure put on us. And I know growing up, I was sold books before boys, books before boys, books before boys, books before boys. So, you know, it wasn't necessarily encouraged relationships because, you know, everybody's sacrificing. So if you're sacrificing, you're working hard towards something, it's difficult to then pursue a romantic relationship as well. So I think Bahamian women have the option. And then I also feel like Bahamian women, we tolerate a lot less. So it may be one minor thing and we say, okay, we step away from it. So, but I feel like it's a very, very personal journey, a very, very personal journey. And I don't think we can necessarily blanket all Bahamian women, because I know women who get married at 21 and who get married at 18, you know, and they've been married 30, 40, 50 years. So it's very personal, but education and romance tends not to mix in the Bahamian population. Because if you're in school, if you're studying, this is what you need to do. So it's just balancing that out.
And as I said, there's no right or wrong mm-hmm. answer, but we had to put into a lot of things into that equation. This is, I've seen top 10, number 6 in the world, most expensive country in the world to live. We have a primarily matriarchal society where most households are, the breadwinner is the woman. So they have overwhelming pressure. And obviously, if you have one child and that relationship doesn't work, it's difficult to ever think to have time for that new relationship because they're so overwhelmed with trying to provide a better life for that one child that they have, and maybe the bitter disappointment of that failed relationship with the father of that child. It's a vicious cycle where, we've said it many times, the nuclear family is becoming almost extinct in this society, and our society is paying for it. We'll talk more about this topic and other interesting topics with Dr. Inga Smith, Bahamian obstetrician and gynecologist.
Miami Gardens presents JITG Music Fest. Janae Aiko, Ludacris, Ashanti, Nelly, Glorilla, LMA, Maya, Joe, D-Nice and Friends, featuring SWV, Donnell Jones, Case, Sunshine Anderson, and Kenny Burns, the Isley Brothers, L. DeBarge, Stephanie Mills, and so many more. March 7th and 8th, Hard Rock Stadium. Tickets and info at jazzinthegardens.com. Jazzinthegardens.com.
Girl, you see how Cora eye look funny all black up yesterday?
But she say she bump into a wall when she's running after the churn them.
Yeah, but last Saturday you see her arm was all black and blue, right?
What you saying? You think something wrong between her and Jack?
I ain't sure, but you know Jack is a jealous man. I hear him and Cora last Friday. I hear him say he hear Cora have eyes for Junior.
Now you know that ain't true. Cora is a good woman, does mind her business, take care of them churn and go to church every Sunday. So what you think we should do?
I think we should report Jack, you know. Cora don't say nothing, but silence hides violence, and we don't want to line up in the cemetery.
Not me. I ain't getting in nobody business. Then Jack come after me and I land up next to Cora.
No, man, we could call or text Crime Stopper. And remember, we can even get some grocery money for our tip.
Remind me again how does this work?
We can call them in Miami at 328-TIPS or 328-8477. Or when we in the island, call toll free at 300-TIPS or 300-8477. And if you don't have no minutes, use the Crack Crime Bahamas app and we could text them. And the messages get on mix up before it leave your phone so nobody can know what you saying.
So what are we waiting on then? Let's go earn some grocery money.
Always on the go? Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back from the break. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto, and I'm pleased to have my guest of honor, Dr. Inger Pratt, who is a Bahamian obstetrician and gynecologist and a Foxal gal. Welcome again. So we were talking a lot about interesting topics of gynecology, and we were delving into obstetrics. What are some of the troubling trends do you see when you are in your public and private practice in terms of female health? Things that can be prevented. Obviously, we spoke about cervical cancer, getting your pap smears. I don't think we stress that. How often should someone get a pap smear, and at what age should they start getting pap smears? And do you get pap smears all the way until death's door?
So pap smears are extremely important. I can't stress that enough. They should be done. So the age to start pap smears would be age 21, whether or not you're sexually active. So age 21, if you're not sexually active, there are small instruments we can use in order to do the pap smear. And pap smears are done annually until age 65. There are certain centers, for instance, in the United States, Canada, and in Europe, where they use their data on women who have been fully vaccinated against HPV, and they recommend pap smears every 3 years. Because we know our population, like you say, we deal with the women who have, you know, the precancerous cells and the cancerous cells, and we see how common it is, we cannot use that data because it's a different population. So it should be annual pap smears until the age of 65, once the previous three paps have been normal.
And I think we need to stress that women need to demand men use a condom.
Correct. But that's easier said than done. As a woman, it's easier said than done. And when you're in the moment, it's difficult to remember, but it protects you against pregnancy. It protects you against sexually transmitted diseases. It protects you against HPV that causes cervical cancer. So it's important. I think if we teach it earlier, that would help. But is our population ready for that to be taught?
HIV is horrible enough, but mm-hmm. with antiretrovirals, HIV has almost become like a chronic illness. Cool. Where you're going to live a long life, healthy just life. Like diabetes and mm-hmm. hypertension, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But we talk about hepatitis, mm-hmm. hepatitis B, hepatitis C, that can lead to liver cancer, and that can kill you a lot faster than HIV. And then we talk about herpes. Once you got herpes, mm-hmm. you carry it around like luggage for life.
Exactly.
You can have breakouts. Mm-hmm. You're not going to remember that one moment. Mm-hmm. You're not going to remember that one moment, whether you're male or female, 20 years ago when you're still having herpetic breakouts with a new partner for the rest of your life. And a lot of that is stress-related. Every time you're under stress, you're having herpetic breakouts, even in your oral cavity right. or down there. Or mm-hmm. imagine meeting a new person, dating somebody, then you're having herpatic breakouts. It can affect your whole outlook on life, your whole outlook on relationships, dating. It can create distrust, trust issues in relationships, etc. And a lot of times there are persons who don't even realize they have herpes and unknowingly give it to their partner, and their partner is the one who's going to be more symptomatic. And it can be a painful ordeal. Men coming to me, even me, with these painful herpetic breakouts on their genitalia, barely able to walk. And obviously they feel down and depressed and everything else, and feel that there's no hope, and they know that there's no cure for herpes. So remember that even when you're young, you don't feel that you can understand that there are consequences for everything you do. If you don't use a condom, you can end up with a child what you're rearing on your own for the next 25 years. That can change the path of your life drastically. If you're drinking and driving and not wearing a seatbelt, and you're 20 years old and you think that nothing can happen to you, we can see you end up in the ICU, or you're in the obituary because you crashed into a pole, etc. You need to be responsible at all times and in every aspect of your life. They cannot have one moment that can change the life to the negative, and you're not going to remember that moment other than to dread the fact that it happened. So please advocate using a condom or being in a committed relationship. There's too much sweethearting. There are too many outside children. That's just going to cause more degradation of the foundation of our society itself. And it keeps getting worse and worse. It keeps getting worse and worse. Nobody knows whose half-brother is out there. Their children in classes, they don't even know that they have the same father, because neither of them even know who the father is. So we need to have more responsibility in our society. But when we talk about having a child at a later age in life, there's obviously the option of freezing eggs. And then let's talk about what are some of the wonderful advances in terms of modern reproductive assistance for women who have little to no eggs. I'll even talk from my perspective. It's not, male infertility really is not an issue because of the advances of modern reproductive technology, where instead of having 250, 300 million perfect sperm with perfect motility and morphology and liquefaction and everything else, you have two or three,
mm-hmm.
and they don't even have any motility. You can use ICSI, intracytoplasmic spermatic injection, directly into the embryo and implant it with IVF, and you may have a 45% chance of having twins, because you're always going to implant two fertilized embryos. So the take-home message, I think, from both of us as urologists, we'll deal with male infertility, and as a gynecologist deals with female infertility, you never give up hope. There's always some way that we can get pregnant. Even in the worst case scenario, you can have donated embryos, mm-hmm. where you can carry the child. There's always surrogates. There's always IVF. I'm sure you have many success stories where people have just given up. And it's the strangest thing. There's so many men out there who are careless and reckless and have 20 children. And then you have that perfect couple who are God-fearing and loving and would make perfect parents, struggling for 10 years to get pregnant. So sometimes you say life is unfair. But everybody has a journey, and God doesn't give us more than we can handle. But the wonderful thing about it is that you can always get pregnant no matter what.
Correct. So there have definitely been advances, especially in terms of access to in vitro fertilization. Like I said, we are surrounded by multiple centers where excellent or high quality in vitro fertilization is available. So we could go to Panama, Cayman, United States, Turkey. So there are a lot more options, and it's becoming more and more affordable. And I think that's the key. It's accessible to a regular person. So in terms of female fertility, like you said, there's embryo adoptions. You can actually adopt a fertilized egg, and the female partner can carry the embryo. Also, there's donor eggs as well, where you can adopt an egg and fertilize that with your partner's sperm and carry that egg and carry that embryo. And there's also emerging technology called ovarian rejuvenation. So it's in its infancy, but there's the potential, or there's a glimmer of hope on the horizon that, you know, you have an ovary and we have all of these young eggs, or, you know, the ovarian function is dropping, but we may be able to rejuvenate them with stem cell sort of technology, and a female partner may be able to use her own eggs or her own genetic material in order to have a baby. So there is definitely hope. There's definitely access. And I encourage people, I push people, even though people tend to not like to go beyond our borders, because unfortunately we do not have IVF in the Bahamas because we don't have embryologists here, it's accessible now, and persons should definitely take advantage of it.
And yes, you never give up hope.
Right.
That's the important take-home message. No matter what, there is going to be a way that you can have that child. And then even in the worst case of scenario, there's so many children out there that want a loving family.
Correct.
Adoption is a wonderful gift that you can give to a child who otherwise would have never had the love that you have to give. So God always puts us on a path, and it's not always for us to question it, but in the end, we could always find happiness if we stay positive and have positive people around us who can guide us. A lot of persons have infertility, both male and female, and that's because of sexually transmitted disease. Let's talk about the scourge in our society of, in many cases, it's silent, from chlamydia to gonorrhea to syphilis. the scourge in our society because of our reckless ways and some in the uniform branch. Mm-hmm. I'll say it as a joke, but it's the truth. Raw as law. It goes without saying. So, and that's the Bahamian man mantra, as you know. Most men, Bahamian men as urologists, would rather cut out their pinky finger than not have a good erection. That's how important it is. That defines them as a man. And for many men, they have this thought that the more children they have, the more of a man they are. And they can't see that that's the opposite of the truth. It takes a real man to raise a child. Having children doesn't make you a father. So when we talk about sexually transmitted diseases, obviously we got to go down the road of antenatal care. It's fundamentally important. Where part of antenatal care is testing for sexually transmitted diseases.
Correct.
Would you advocate as a couple going down the aisle before they get married to get the full gamut of HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, et cetera, before they start to go down the aisle and start their life together?
So I advocate sexually active persons to have the testing done annually, regardless of any commitment they may have. I think it's very, very important to know February 2nd of 2026, my tests were negative. And definitely, I believe, before entering a new relationship, you should definitely get sexually transmitted illness testing, both the male and the female partner. So that's extremely important. And
but you just said, you said testing every year. But what if the woman says and starts cursing, you said, I'm faithful to my man. What are you trying to say? I have a man on the side, everything?
I've never been cursed before.
Okay. You're lucky.
One or two persons may say to me, all I say to them is this is just a part of routine. I advocate for it as a part of routine annual testing, the same way you check for your cholesterol and everything.
You heard something about my man in the streets. Why do you think I'm in danger? Why do I need to get tested?
I don't discuss people in the streets, so I definitely can't hear anything. But in general, people tend to do the testing because you incorporate it as a part of just routine testing. It's not anything extraordinary. It's just like how condom use should be a routine thing, knowing your status. In terms of sexually transmitted diseases, you should, at this point in time, always know what your status is. So if it's routine testing or, you know, offered, because I think a lot of times the testing isn't done because it's not even offered. You know, whether they're married, single, not currently sexually active, it's important to offer the testing.
So even when you start a relationship, let's say a young woman comes to you, you're her obstetrician, you're her gynecologist, since the age of 16, and she said, I'm 25 years old right now. My boyfriend, I just met a few weeks ago, came to me. He has HIV negative status in his laboratory results. All other STIs are negative. Is it safe for her to proceed? Because HIV, there's an incubation period. So he may have been exposed to HIV, and he may not be able to test positively for 3 months, for 4 months. What is your advice in that regard?
So in general, when they're ready to have intercourse, if they have negative testing, yes, there is an incubation period, but I usually don't dissuade them from, you know, having intercourse unprotected if that's their particular choice. So obviously the first choice always
is. But do you make them aware that there is an incubation?
Yes, I do. I do. So, and it's difficult to say wait 3 months and test again because the testing can sometimes be expensive as well. So I think that the risk overall is very low because we could see in our antenatal testing, we always test for HIV at the initial visit and then we test again at 32 weeks. And very rare, if ever, you see a positive test from that early test and the repeat test. So overall, I think that the risk is a bit low, but they should be educated that there is an incubation period for HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases.
And let's even say, God forbid, you are going to antenatal care and you find out that you're HIV positive. You can have a child who's HIV negative. Can
Correct.
We speak about that?
Correct.
That happens all of the time.
So we have great docs in the Bahamas. We have great infrastructure where we manage, like you said, HIV very, very well. It's more of a chronic medical condition at this point. And there are medications that can be started, antiretroviral medications that help to keep the virus low in the mom's bloodstream And it helps to prevent transmission to the baby. We always check the virus levels before delivery. If they're very low, mom can even push. We give retroviral medications at the time of delivery. And it's important that the mother does not breastfeed. So we give medication to prevent breast milk and we formula feed the baby. But definitely there's prevention of transmission to the baby. And then, of course, the pediatrician tests, again, several times just to make sure that the baby does not pick up the condition.
And let's say a woman is going to have a natural delivery, a vaginal delivery, and they have a herpetic breakout. Is it a relative contraindication to have a vaginal delivery if someone has active herpetic breakout as a mother?
So it's a contraindication. So if there's an active lesion, we avoid exposure to the vaginal mucosa as the baby's being delivered. So the data really says if it's sort of infection is very aggressive, then it's even more risk. But there's still a small risk of transmission to the baby during the vaginal delivery process. So if there's active lesions, then it's best to have a cesarean section.
And let's try to promote the most important God's nectar, breastfeeding.
Yes, I love breastfeeding.
It's the most important thing a woman can give to her child in terms of immunity, in terms of growth, and in terms of nutrients and everything else.
And bonding as well.
So
breastfeeding is great. I personally breastfed and I loved it because, first of all, breast milk is free because formula is insanely expensive. It's free, it's easily accessible. You don't have to warm up milk. You don't have to tote this, tote that. So, and like you said, you pass on important immunity to the baby.
And you can pump the breast milk.
You can pump and store it.
And the father can also participate in using the bottle to...
Correct.
Yes.
So definitely I advocate for breastfeeding and prepare mom for breastfeeding. Obviously, not everyone is able to exclusively breastfeed, and that's understandable. But even if you can supplement the formula with breast milk as much as possible, then that would confer benefit as well.
One of the greatest health challenges we have in our country is obesity, but particularly childhood obesity. We go down the road of something that a lot of people don't like to talk about because a lot of women get insulted, but maternal obesity. When you're pregnant and you're overeating, and you say, I'm eating for two, don't worry about me, I have my cravings. Maternal obesity, and you can have gestational diabetes that can even lead to you having diabetes beyond delivery. That can lead to an obese infant, that can lead to an obese young child, that can lead to an obese teenager, can lead to an obese adult. How do we address that in terms of women staying healthy, in terms of their calorie intake, their nutrient intake, a well-balanced diet, getting exercise when they're pregnant? And not only that, another controversial topic, a lot of women in our society, they'll gain 30 pounds, they'll gain 40 pounds when they have a child, and they never lose it. And that just starts a dangerous, slippery slope where that 50 pounds is something that they put on and then have another child and it becomes 80 pounds.
So I think the best thing would be preconception counseling, where most women who are overweight or obese during pregnancy tend to come into the pregnancy overweight or obese. And like you said, that increases your risk for abnormalities with the baby, gestational diabetes, traumatic birth. Increases your risk for cesarean section as well. So there are risks associated with it. So it's just trying to get our population as a whole as healthy as possible. We do advocate as obstetricians for weight gain in pregnancy. That's very, very important regardless of your starting weight. Obviously, if your weight is higher, the weight gain is less. But that's important for the baby's brain development. So during pregnancy, that's not the time when I would tell a patient to necessarily diet. So it's always advocating for a healthy, well-balanced diet, as fresh foods as possible, and just trying to reduce their overall risk. But in general, trying to maintain a healthy population would be the most important thing. And then hitting those weight loss targets after delivery. So breastfeeding helps significantly with weight loss. So that's very, very important. And it's a great tool. And just sort of educating persons about diet and exercise, which I think as a population, we have challenges with in terms of healthy eating, because we're always moving around fast food, or, you know, it's harder and harder to have healthier options. But I think Bahamians are trying, you know, it's less of the peas and rice sort of dynamic and more moving towards salad. It may be a salad with like bacon and eggs and everything else on it, but we're moving to more into a healthier diet, and then we have to get more active. I think that's our challenge. We're not active, and I can say that as well. Like, my challenge is getting up and moving consistently, and if we have avenues for that, I think that would definitely help.
I want you to address a very common tragedy that is not spoken about openly enough, and that's excess alcohol intake by pregnant women in our society. So let's talk about some of the terrible health dilemmas for the child because of that, and why can you, just from an obstetrician point of view, what are the dangers of a woman drinking excessively when she's pregnant?
So it could result in a low birth weight fetus. It could cause miscarriages, stillbirths. It could cause fetal alcohol syndrome, which we rarely see because you have to drink really excessively. So I think in general, most women really try to significantly stop drinking. They may drink early pregnancy before they find out they're pregnant, but once they know most, I'd say most people would try and really pull back on the drinking. But it can cause significant issues with the fetus.
And what are some of the classes of medications that you should really avoid when you're pregnant and when you're breastfeeding? Obviously, narcotics would be number one.
Right. So you wouldn't
avoid. And then obviously there are some drugs that are carcinogenic, and you have to avoid at all costs.
Right. So every medication you take while pregnant, you should clear with your doctor first. So certain even painkillers should be avoided because they can cause complications in the pregnancy and have been linked with neurological conditions such as autism or neurodivergence. And certain antibiotics, for instance, can cause limb deformities, bony deformities. And certain people who have certain medical conditions, their medications may cause issues. Certain high blood pressure medicines, which is very, hypertension is very common in our population. So certain high blood pressure medicines need to be changed prior to pregnancy. Certain diabetes medicine need to be changed prior to pregnancy or during pregnancy. So there are a whole list that's actually less medication you can actually take than what you can take. So before you take anything, you should discuss it with their obstetrician, because the list is very wide.
And antenatal care in this country is completely free. So there's there's no excuse. You are going to raise a child into their early 20s. You can take an hour to make sure that your child is going to be born healthy.
Correct. So national health insurance is now available, where if you're on national health insurance, you can be referred to any obstetrician who's under national health insurance.
So essentially, you can be a quote-unquote private patient.
Correct.
Under the government's coverage without having to pay anything.
Correct. Yes. All you need is a referral from your primary care provider, primary NHI doctor, to any of the obstetricians. So you can actually be seen by an obstetric specialist, particularly if you're a high-risk pregnancy. So it is readily available. We have community clinics in every single community. So honestly, it may take longer than an hour, to be honest, but whether you seek private or public care for OB care, it may take an hour or two, but you're getting the best care that you can get. And even if you cannot come, you know, for as frequent of a visit, if you come relatively regularly, that would significantly reduce any complications that you may have. And I know sometimes people are afraid because they hear about poor outcomes and, you know, the baby not doing as well on mommy not
important
doing as well.
To come there with your husband, come there with your boyfriend, come there with your mother to have support. Don't go there alone.
Correct.
Because you're not bringing this child into this world alone, and it takes a village to raise a child successfully. Yes. There's not enough of that in our society. We're losing our way because of that. So there are too many women out there feel isolated. Oh, when they found out they're pregnant, the boyfriend left them, and they feel that the life is over, and they're literally depressed with this pregnancy. There's always someone to lean on, and even if it means a social worker or et cetera, there's always someone to lean on. Someone in the church, a pastor, someone in the church group, et cetera, your neighbor. Don't feel that you're all alone and you're going through this all alone. And particularly when you give birth, please know that there's someone there to help you.
Correct.
You're not helpless. And that's, there are too many children, first of all, having children. There's too much in the way of teenage pregnancy, and there are too many persons having children when they are not, do not have the ability to care for that child in so many, whether that's emotionally or financially, or it's the wrong time of life. And that's where birth control is all important in whatever form that is. But you obviously, as an obstetrician, as a urologist, we always talk about the importance of using birth control for so many reasons. It can save your life. It can change, make sure that your life isn't changed from light to darkness. Although every child is a blessing from God, but if you're 18 years old and you're trying to go off to university and you have a child, that can change your path. And you can always wait that 4 years, that 5 years, and have that child within marriage. I think that's the take-home message for our society. There isn't enough of that. So we've said a lot. I think we imparted a lot of great information. I think you've changed lives. And in particular, I don't want to hear any more about teenagers, young women coming into hospital with a hemoglobin of 5 because they have chronic heavy bleeding from periods. There are things that can be done. Don't let a period debilitate you and cause you depression. Dr. Inga Pratt from Foxdale, obstetrician and Bahamian gynecologist, where can someone find you if they want to get your care?
I'm at Advanced Health Center on the corners of Montrose Avenue and Durham Street in Centerville.
Okay. And is there a telephone number?
We're on 393-0614-05.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, and I hope you come again. Have a very fruitful and safe week, Bahamas, and good night. This is Urologist Speaks.
Live better, live stronger with the help of Doc. Man, we live in longer. You got to know just where you stand. Tune in with us today. And the Urologist Speaks. And the Urologist.